inaugural address in January, President Trump promised to bring back free speech to America. Since then, Trump and his administration have made that line look ridiculous again and again and again. This is the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Corbin Barthold. We could have done about a half dozen episodes on this theme over the last 10 months. I'm sorry we didn't. But we are going to catch up today. Joining me to discuss all the free speech hypocrisy is my podcast BFF, Ari Cohn, lead counsel for tech policy at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Ari, sir, welcome back.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
There are so many different attacks on free speech coming from this administration. As I was preparing for this, didn't really even know where to start. So we're going to do things a little differently today. I have made a game show wheel. We only do audio for this podcast, so listeners are just going to have to take my word for it that there's a giant colorful wheel in my home office here with a bunch of different wedges, each one with one of the heinous unconstitutional things that this administration is up to. Ari, are you down to play the game?
Yeah, I imagine that underneath each wedge is just a gigantic pile of shit.
Yes. Well, maybe we should just call it the wheel of shit. Oh, man. We always have to click the explicit button in our episodes for you. We didn't make it 2 minutes. Okay, here we go. Law firms. We have law firms. Okay, so there are a couple different angles here. There's the deals that the Trump administration has struck with big law firms. There is the more general attack on the legal profession writ large. Ari, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, you saw at the beginning of this administration's term, the very first thing basically that Donald Trump did was start issuing executive orders against law firms who had represented people that he didn't like. And that you haven't heard much about that in recent months, mostly because the zone has been flooded with other shit. But you know, we forget that what he was doing was stripping security clearances, which impacts lawyers' ability to get the information they need to handle certain things, to enter certain federal buildings, to represent certain clients. There's a whole bunch of federal contractors that wondered if their lawyers were going to be able to adequately represent them. So there were two ways of responding to this. You had the Skadden's of the world who, like, you know, good little obedient clowns, entered into fast settlement agreements with the administration and said, oh, we're going to give you $200 bazillion of free legal pro bono work for causes that you want. And then there were the other law firms who said, no, we're going to take you to court and fight this. And they pretty universally, I think, got injunctions against the worst parts of the executive orders. And then, you know, obviously there was the reaction from everybody else, most of which were wondering how a law firm who couldn't stick up for itself could be trusted to adequately and zealously defend clients, which is, I think, a very fair question. And the other question was exactly what does this pro bono work entail? And we haven't really figured that out yet. And I guarantee you he's just holding on to that chip to call in that favor whenever he finds it particularly necessary. I don't know, maybe after he's out of office and some state AGs enterprising a criminal complaint against him again. Who knows? But the, you know, the real effect of that whole situation was that the legal profession's trust in itself took a big hit. There was a lot of high-profile exits from firms that reached settlement agreements with the Trump administration. There was a lot of mobilization to make it hurt for the law firms that really wouldn't stand up for themselves. And let's be clear, just I haven't said this, so I've implied it. The executive orders were all horse crap. Like, there was absolutely no reason why a United States president should be exacting retribution on law firms for representing clients that he didn't like. That is just profoundly at odds with the rule of law and the founding principles of this country. I mean, John Adams represented British soldiers. Like, this is baked into our country. And Donald Trump seems intent on unbaking the cake and rebaking it with his own set of ingredients.
An administration comes in and it decides it's going to attack all of the powerful institutions in society, all of the institutions that lie between government and the individual. And it's a Gramscian attitude that your enemies have obtained cultural hegemony, and so you're going to try to undermine that. Now, with that as the starting point, if you just lash out everywhere, sometimes you're going to make attacks that are more valid than others. Now, the process by which you do that may be completely barbarian and against our system. This may be a preview of when we get to other institutions. Sometimes you're going to find misbehavior if you lash out in all directions. The thing about the law firms is it was completely bogus. Every law firm that fought the administration quickly won in court, every law firm that stood up for itself. And yet we had these other law firms. You said Skadden. I want to throw Paul Weiss in there. They definitely should be named and shamed. Yeah. You had these law firms that caved immediately in the face of a stiff breeze. They didn't stand up for themselves, even though they were firmly in the right, which is pretty disturbing coming from the legal profession in particular. There was a good article in The New Yorker that I'll put in the show notes saying, of all the institutions that have caved in the face of Trump, law firms probably should feel the most ashamed of themselves. The legal profession has a pretty exalted view of itself, both, as you mentioned, because they represent both the powerful and the powerless, and they represent the client that the mob is screaming at, and because law is so fundamental to our society and lawyers uphold the rule of law. So there's certainly a large grain of truth to that exalted view of itself, but it's been completely betrayed here. It looks like a complete sham when Paul Weiss immediately, I mean, it was fast. It was days before they reached an agreement and said, how high do you want us to jump? And I think the damage that we're going to see from this will be very, very long lasting. I think of the fallout when Ronald Sullivan, Harvard professor, represented or did some legal work for Harvey Weinstein. And he got in big trouble at Harvard because younger people who maybe I could say are not steeped in our American tradition to the degree that I would like and take a more Marxist view of things and look at everything as power structures, they looked at this man representing Harvey Weinstein and they saw that as unambiguously bad. You don't represent the bad guy. As a lawyer, you find the quote unquote right side and don't represent the bad defendant. And that's got everything backwards. But when Paul Weiss comes in and immediately caves like this, the next time there is an episode like what happened to Ronald Sullivan, the people who say it's a moral black mark on you for representing a sordid client, they'll have a lot more ammunition in that claim because the law firms that caved, I should say, have made it look like it is true that they blow in the wind, they're subject to pressure, they're just acting in their own interests, they're covering their own asses. It's really a shame. What I'm wondering about now, recently we got a DC bar opinion pointing out the fact that it's not just that you caved to the administration. You caved to an aspiring authoritarianism who is going to change the terms of the deal as it fits him. We actually, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't even really know the details of these agreements. They may be handshake agreements.
You got press releases vaguely describing them, but
yeah. So the DC bar opinion says, well, your other clients who maybe need to litigate against the government, you now have a conflict of interest with them and you need to disclose that to those clients. And one principle of legal ethics is a client is perfectly capable of waiving a conflict if the client wants, because the client is entitled to the lawyer that the client wants. But how do you knowingly waive a conflict if at the root of that conflict is an agreement with another client, the terms of which could change at any moment? So the Paul Weiss Skadden people made a deal with the devil, have a tiger by the tail, whatever metaphor you want to use. And as I think you alluded to, like, it's going to hurt for them, and it should hurt for them. They're now between a rock and a hard place. And I don't know if I have a good answer for what should happen other than that it should hurt for them. And I'm glad about that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, the other reason that's kind of a corollary of what I was saying earlier is, you know, the legal profession is going to be one of the last bulwarks against government's ultimate nefarious and mendacious aims. Like, this is like the courts are basically the last step before civil war in most cases. Like, and I don't want to say nervously. That. Like, yeah, it's not a comfortable thing to say, but it's true. If the courts can't resolve constitutional crisis, the legal profession cannot help guide us back to a point where we can resolve things peacefully and within the bounds of political and constitutional rules, there is very little stopping this from getting very ugly very quickly.
Very ugly very quickly, yes. One other thing I will mention before we move on, I alluded to it at the outset. More broadly, the administration issued I can't remember now as I sit here whether it was a memo or an executive order or what's even the difference, but it directed the Department of Justice to seek Rule 11 sanctions against law firms that litigate against the federal government, and to do so with a very backward-looking view to anything that they can complain about in litigation that has occurred in the past or is going on in the present. Clearly just meant to be a fear tactic to make people hesitant about litigating against the government. As a former litigator, I say with frustration that Rule 11 sanctions are never imposed. I mean, you have to just really, you have to try hard to get Rule 11 sanctions, and they are a high bar to meet. And maybe as a matter of first principles, I wish lawyers got sanctioned more often for misbehavior. But to pick that up and act like it is an appropriate thing to swing around against lawyers whose only sin is that they've challenged the government in court, that is unethical. The government should get Rule 11 sanctions for frivolous Rule 11 sanctions motions. I don't know to what degree the government's lawyers have actually tried to act on that memo, but we see intimidation tactics against lawyers, not just law firms that Trump has a personal bone to pick with, but more broadly. And that is unfortunate. Because we're doing specifically free speech stuff, I'm not going to dive into the hollowing out of the Department of Justice, which is another whole topic. I'll just put a pin in that. Bad stuff going on in the legal world. Okay, back to the wheel of shit. Domestic terrorism. Particularly Antifa on my mind, but as with the law firms, there's a narrow and a broad tactic that's going on with the administration. Domestic political opponents of the administration are apparently terrorist groups now. Ari, what say you?
I don't want to explain this. You explain this. No, I'm kidding. Listen, the hyperventilation over Antifa since, like, I don't know, 2016 has really been somewhat amusing. But it's been mostly confined to people caterwauling on Twitter or, you know, whatever saying it in their campaign speeches or their TV spots. But now we have an administration who is saying, I'm going to go after Antifa, and I'm going to direct the Department of Justice to investigate and try and curtail their activities. The problem is Antifa, A, isn't a thing. It's just not like an organization that you can investigate. But what this executive order really is a veneer, a facade behind which to investigate everyone who funds or organizes for causes that he doesn't like. This is the excuse to investigate all kinds of left-leaning groups and George Soros and whatever boogeyman they can come up with next for allegedly funding or organizing domestic terrorism, quote unquote, which is preposterous. And, you know, it's pretty obvious to everyone that that's exactly what it is. And, you know, the idea, I don't know, we're basically just like Patriot acting ourselves all over again here in a way. Except even worse, because like not even Congress agreed to this. It's just Donald Trump saying, I'm going to use agency authority to go after all these people. Like this, there's very little stopping him from making a whole lot of people's lives very difficult solely because they advocate for causes that Donald Trump doesn't agree with, which is again fundamentally at odds with the entire genesis of this country. I'm going to say that probably every single time in this episode, but here we are.
It's fascinating to me how we are reliving issues that arose during the war on terror, but now we're 10xing it. Bombing drug boats being an interesting example. I try to picture what the reaction would have been to that kind of behavior in 2007. And now it's just one thing within so many other stories that it gets not all that much attention. It's wild. So I think the first thing I would mention here is domestic terror group is not a thing in the law. You can't designate a domestic terrorist group. That doesn't have any meaning. So what we have is an executive order that uses that label as if it means something to just go after political opponents. Your colleague at FIRE, Matthew Harwood, had a good article in the Dispatch getting into this. He pulled out a quote from the Investigate Domestic Terror Groups executive order. It says, quote, common threads animating the violent conduct that is going on include anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, support for the overthrow of the United States government, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and hostility towards those who hold traditional American views on family, religion, and morality.
The shorter version of that is dissent is domestic terrorism.
People who don't view the world the way we do. I don't even know. If you had an executive order that just flipped everything, that people who do hold traditional American views on family, religion, and morality are suspect, I think it would be pretty clear to the people who might support this order what the problem is. Anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, what could be more American than having those views, quite frankly? America is a land where you get to speak your mind and say crazy shit. That's America. So it's very disappointing to see an executive order that is, in effect, political opponents need to be investigated. But then, to make it even more disturbing, apparently the next shoe to drop here is that the administration plans to designate Antifa a foreign terrorist organization based on some thin read. And then things get real. Domestic terrorist organization means that's meaningless gobbledygook. Foreign terrorist organization is a legal term, and all kinds of consequences flow from being designated a foreign terrorist organization. It is very illegal to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. So this,
but there has to be an organization first.
Presumably there will be legal challenges if this happens, but it is very disturbing that there's a clear strategy here in which these two things are connected. You issue an order saying anti-Americanism is something we're going to investigate. We are actually going to get our joint task force on terrorism in the FBI digging into these groups. And then we're going to designate at least one of these very loose, amorphous concepts, like you say, not an organization, a foreign terrorist organization, and then potentially start prosecuting people for quote unquote materially supporting that, prison terms being connected to that. I mean, this is serious intimidation.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, like as it comes, like as it applies to quote unquote Antifa, like how do you even, if you designated Antifa as a foreign designated terrorist organization, how do you enforce that? Like, who is giving money to banned? Like, what the problem is, you say that and like, you understand it's ridiculous, but that's entirely the point, because then it means whatever they want it to mean. And then it means whoever you give to, I can say you were giving to Antifa, because I can just claim that that is part of Antifa, because Antifa has not a defined thing. And therefore, we can just make it mean whatever we want it to. So that's probably the gambit.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same problem with the quote war on terror. Terror is not a coherent thing you can combat. You quickly are going to have mission creep if that's what you're going after. And Antifa
here
is a stand-in for anti-Americanism. So the sweep here could be extraordinarily broad.
And it will be.
Shall we go back to the wheel?
I mean, we know it's coming. More shit, so I guess.
All right.
The only other option is to just stop here.
No. Oh, no. So much more to go. Oh, my goodness. Brendan Carr. I made this such a small wedge on the wheel, and here it still landed on it. All right, you and I have done Brendan Carr before.
Yeah, don't say it like that.
But the guy merits more attention. Okay, what has happened since the last time we talked about Brendan Carr?
Was the last time we talked about Brendan Carr?
We talked about him in our preview of the Trump administration back
January.
So I will put that in the show notes as well. He was already making, he was giving a preview of the things he planned to do back then, and now some of those things have come to fruition. But I will let you take us in whatever direction you want. We could have a whole Brendan Carr wheel unto himself. So I don't want to force your hand. You know, go where you want.
I mean, let's do reverse chronological order, I suppose. Just the other month, I guess now it's 2 months ago, Jimmy Kimmel gets up, does a monologue after the murder of Charlie Kirk, in which he says a whole bunch of things and makes some insinuations that turn out to be wrong as part of his opening bit. And the right predictably went indiscriminately crazy, as, you know, that particular moment in time was even more insane than things usually are, and started demanding, Jimmy Kimmel's got to be taken off the air. And then Brendan Carr decides that he's going to do the dumbest thing he can possibly think of. And that is to threaten ABC and Disney with, you know, examination and possible revocation of their affiliate licenses, and literally uttering the words, "We can do this the easy way or the hard way." Within like 2 hours, Jimmy Kimmel had been suspended and taken off the air. And the crazy thing is not necessarily that the FCC applied pressure against content it doesn't like. We've seen that happen many times before. The truly remarkable and insane thing about this was the direct line, the immediate response that we saw from ABC, Disney, like the chain of events was clear. The causation could not have been more clear. We never really see it that obviously, but Brendan Carr in the past, I don't know, year has made it his business to ensure that people understand that the FCC will actually take action against anyone it can find with any tool it can find if they say things that he or Brendan Carr or Donald Trump doesn't like. And we saw that with the Paramount Skydance merger, where, you know, they were going to hold it up, and then lo and behold, there's the lawsuit about the CBS 60 Minutes edit gets settled for an insane amount of money, considering that that lawsuit would have been tossed out incredibly easily. And not only that, but as part of it, CBS has to install an ombudsman, literally a jawboning complaint hotline. Like, this is a person whose job it is to take complaints from the government about the content on the air. And I don't know. I mean, you really just, at that point, CBS ceases to be like a journalistic outlet. Like, you cannot have a direct hotline complaint from the government over your news coverage and still have any reasonable like idea that you are conducting journalism. That's just not how it works. There's a precedent that Carr had set, and Disney and ABC said, oh, okay, well, we see that Brendan Carr means it when he says we can do this the easy way or the hard way. He is going to actually find a way to make our life difficult. So they caved. And just, what is there to say about that? Like, it's just batshit crazy that that happened in plain view for everyone to see. And this is, I mean, a lot of what we're talking about today has to do with institutional backbone and that being a huge problem. And that was the problem here. Disney and ABC weren't willing to stand up for themselves. It's very hard for anyone else to stand up or make a difference on behalf of people who aren't willing to do it for themselves. So when all these media outlets, when the universities, when the law firms, when they cave, the rest of us are effectively powerless to do anything about the decay of civil liberties, because the people who it is impacting in that moment will not stand up for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, as my colleague Bob Kornrevere aptly put it, a spine is a terrible thing to waste. But unfortunately, we've got a bunch of paraplegic institutions here.
The normie liberal attitude about independent agencies, I don't know, the Cass Sunstein depiction of them, these things are independent.
Cass Sunstein being what one thinks of when you say the word normie, of course.
Am I wrong?
I mean, normie to a very select group of people. You say the word normie to 9.9 out of 10 people in American society, and I guarantee you don't get Cass Sunstein.
No. In legal nerd world, I guess I needed to give that qualification. People who think about administrative law. Thank you for forcing me to spell
it. You are not normie if you regularly think about administrative law just as a general proposition. But
the idea is you have these agencies, and the reason that they are independent is so that they can display expertise, dispassionate expertise wielded in the public interest. And the conservative critique of that has long been that that's a facade, that actually experts wind up having political opinions, and by making agencies independent, you are insulating those agencies from political accountability. I will naively admit that if you could go in a time machine and talk to me in 2012, I would find that conservative critique very compelling. Brendan Carr has embarrassed that conservative critique. People in the media have occasionally analogized him to a pit bull or a bulldog for President Trump, and Brendan Carr is very proud of that. He uses it for social media fodder. In reality, what he is a lapdog. He has been willing to flip all of his principles in service of Donald Trump. He literally wears a Donald Trump lapel pin.
Which, for the record, looks more like Barney Rubble than Donald Trump, which is fitting.
There's only so much we can cover in this episode. I just checked out his X feed last night, and he's tweeting about stuff referring to the, quote, Schumer shutdown. Does this sound like a dispassionate expert trying to serve the public interest when he, as the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, is tweeting out the partisan talking point from the administration about the shutdown and trying to pin it on a Democratic senator.
Not just that, he responded to Chuck Schumer with a whole bunch of that kind of bile when Schumer said, CBS edited down a long, rambly Donald Trump interview. I guess I should file a complaint like the one that was filed against CBS for editing the Kamala Harris one. And without an ounce, a single tiny droplet of self-awareness, Brendan Carr, aside, you know, went into a whole bunch of Schumer shutdown nonsense, but then also said that would be a frivolous complaint.
I saw that.
That, the only thing that shows, and he's right, it would be a frivolous complaint. But given how he was very eager to pursue the complaint against CBS, it demonstrates that his idea of what constitutes a frivolous news distortion complaint has absolutely nothing to do with law, regulation, or principle. It has everything to do with whether he likes the speech.
Exactly. So he's talking the way a Republican House member might, and talking in a way that would be, the word I'll use is excusable from a Republican House member, but he is supposed to be running an agency that deals with technical subjects. And what he's showing is the disaster of taking these agencies and just making them raw political bodies. You brought up the CBS merger. He is using his power in every place as a choke point to serve partisan ends. And there are lots of directions we could go with that. But when I see the CBS, it distills it very neatly. Donald Trump brings a totally bogus lawsuit meant to intimidate CBS based on the way it edits a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. And instead of coming out and sticking up for the First Amendment, Brendan Carr is happy to tag team with that lawsuit and hang a merger review process on whether that lawsuit settles favorably to Donald Trump. It's not an accident that CBS settles with Trump for $16 million, bogus lawsuit, and then Carr goes ahead and approves an $8 billion merger between Skydance and the owner of CBS, Paramount. That's raw political corruption. I don't think we need to reiterate right now all of our beef with Brendan Carr using the, quote, public interest standard, weaponizing it. We have gone through that before. I will refer everybody to our episode earlier on the Trump administration that will be in the show notes for that, because we just have so much to cover. We have other things on the wheel, so sorry, we have to leave Brendan Carr. All right. Meta takes down ICE tracking group. All right.
Yeah, this one really got my goat. I mean, there are so many stupid things about this. Like the genesis of it is that
layers of stupidity. Yes,
it's a fucking onion. There was a whole bunch of Facebook groups dedicated, and particularly in the Chicago area where I am, to letting people know where ICE is operating, either for the purpose of, you know, going to protest or like just safety issues, or even hell, just where is there going to be terrible traffic? The answer is everywhere in Chicago. And DOJ doesn't much like this, because DOJ and DHS apparently think that it's doxing to even like know who an ICE agent is. So obviously where they're operating in public can't be public information. And they put a lot of pressure on Meta, which then removed those groups. This, by the way, is the same company that just recently decided, oh, you know how else we're going to like lick Donald Trump's shoes? We're going to say we really were jawboned by the Biden administration, even after we denied it for years and years and years. We really were. And we regret how we responded at that point. We should have pushed back. And then what do? Well, they don't really do the thing that they said they wished they did the first time, because the second DOJ came calling and said, you got to remove these groups, boom, they were gone. And it happened with app stores too. There was the IceBlock app. And it's just a remarkable demonstration about how it's only jawboning if I like the speech from the government's perspective. And frankly, again, spinelessness of institutions. I would not necessarily call social media companies institutions, or at least they shouldn't be in a socially meaningful way. But the fact that Meta just like recently was like, yeah, we were jawboned and, you know, we regret not sticking up for ourselves, and then immediately did not stick up for themselves, shows you how thin their whatever words that comes out of their mouth are. Like, they're really, it's just hollow nonsense. They're going to say whatever they need to say in a moment, and that's fine. They're a business. But don't get up here, Mark Zuckerberg, and say we need to return to our free speech roots and make a whole big spiel about it, like you actually give a shit about free speech, when the second you're only saying that to placate Donald Trump, and the second Donald Trump doesn't like the speech, you're going to take it down. You're full of shit. And if you want to get up there and don the cloak and take the mantle of free speech and really, you know, try to take that virtue for yourself, you better be willing to walk the walk. And so far, he hasn't.
Thank you. You've done well on Meta's hypocrisy, so I can hit on the administration's hypocrisy. The administration issued an executive order, I think on the day of the inauguration or the day after, saying the Biden administration engaged in un-American jawboning, and it was heinous. It was awful. And listeners of the show will know that the Biden administration worked with social media companies to deal with misinformation during COVID-19, dealt with some other stuff. And as Ari and I have discussed on the show before, wasn't the best look, not great for the administration to be pressuring social media companies, but also not threats in a way that, you know, rise to the level of a First Amendment violation. We don't approve of it, but also the Constitution doesn't swoop in and solve everything that you don't like. We now have, so they do that. And then I think it's worth reading Attorney General Pam Bondi's tweet announcing the taking down of this group. She says, today, the pride, the preening here of doing the exact opposite of that executive order is unbelievable. Today, following outreach from the Justice Department, outreach. Pressure from the government is now outreach.
She admitted.
Following outreach from the Justice Department, Facebook removed a large group page that was being used to dox and target ICE agents in Chicago. With dox here meaning knowing their locations, which is protected by the First Amendment.
In public, not even like private locations, like where they are on the street. Like, it doesn't get more public than that.
The mask falls off so badly here. The First Amendment is to us a cudgel to use when we are out of power to claim victimhood, and is used when we are in power to beat on victims. The cynicism blows my mind. And I say that as a pretty cynical person. Also worth mentioning here, Pam Bondi, following the Charlie Kirk assassination, said that she wanted to go after hate speech. I will say, it's worth noting, she got a lot of pushback on this, including from her political allies, which, take your W's where you can. I found that heartening. If there is one thing that conservative world needs to stand by, it is the notion that hate speech is an amorphous concept that can be used as a political weapon against people and ultimately trends inevitably toward takedown speech that the listener finds offensive, which real endpoint.
Even more directly, always trends towards takedown speech the government doesn't like. I mean, the number one thing that the government thinks is hate speech is speech that hates the government.
And so her using that term was the final dam potentially breaking, I you know, at least she got a lot of pushback there, and it became more an illustration that Pam Bondi doesn't really know what she's talking about or know what she's doing and is a very mediocre attorney. Okay, let's give that wheel one more spin. Universities. I think I'm going to throw student visas in there as well. So I mentioned earlier about the notion of if you lash out at all these different targets, you're going to find some meritorious arguments somewhere. The first thing I need to note before I get into this, that doesn't mean that the way the administration has gone about things has been proper. So we have the Trump administration just blanket cutting off funding for things like research, past grants that have been granted to universities. That's not the proper way to go about this. Now, that said, I think the administration has found itself on the strongest footing or has the most leverage against some universities who are caught with their pants down on turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism or not caring that the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action. And so this one's a little uglier in the sense that the universities made themselves a vulnerable target. Now, with that caveat, I don't look at this and see good guys anywhere, and I see a lot of targeting of free speech from the administration all the same, notwithstanding everything I just said. The mistakes, in my view, made by universities here are an excuse. They are just an entry point for the administration to do all the same authoritarian stuff that they want to do anyway. And we've also seen that. So we've seen victories for the universities. We've seen losses for the universities. With that by way of setup, Ari, what are your thoughts?
I mean, once again, we have spineless institutions caving, and this has been happening since the very beginning of the administration. I mean, listen, I'm actually going to drag us a tiny bit off topic here to another topic, but it's related, I promise. Just the other week, you had Katie Miller, Stephen Miller's wife, doing a debate with the Young Turks guy, whose name I will never try to pronounce ever. And he was basically calling her position full of shit. And she was responded in the most petulant, childish way by saying, "You better hope that all the information on your immigration paperwork was correct. Otherwise, you're going to end up like Ilhan Omar," which doesn't make any sense because she's a congresswoman and still a citizen. So, like, is she offering him a promotion? I don't know. But the subtext was, "We're going to deport you. We're going to look for a technical deficiency in your immigration paperwork and strip you of citizenship because I don't like what you're saying right now." A lot of people said, well, you know, if there's problems with immigration paperwork, he should. And it's the same thing, you know, kind of this is the tie into your lead-ins that, you know, are there things that universities could be investigated for that they may or may not actually, like, have issues with? Yes, undoubtedly. But if you recall 12 years ago, which is, I know, like 11 years, 11 months, and 2 days longer than most people's attention span these days, but if you remember 12 years ago when the IRS was targeting conservative groups for special scrutiny, there was outrage, condemnation. There was calls for Lois Lerner to basically be hung by her thumbs from, like, the Washington Monument or something. Like, people were outraged that she was targeting conservative groups. But if it's not a problem to go on a fishing expedition and look for issues because the ultimate conduct is punishable, and you're doing it for an improper reason, then what was the problem with what the IRS was doing? If those conservative groups weren't rigorously complying with the tax code, don't they deserve to suffer the consequences? No, the outrage was because they were targeted based on their views and expression. And that's what's happening with all the people that they're looking to strip citizenship from. That's what's happening with the universities. The basis, the entire reason the administration is looking into it is retaliation against speech they don't like. And that, I mean, to borrow the criminal a phrase from, you know, the criminal side of the law, is that makes the whole thing fruit of the poisonous tree. Like, you have started off this entire enterprise with the purpose of retaliating against views you don't like. That rots the entire enterprise.
That's totally fair. I look at this and I see a wide range of different things that are happening, and I have different reactions to them if I view them in isolation. So if a bizarro universe President Mitt Romney had showed up and simply gone after Columbia for turning a blind eye to harassment of Jewish students and extracted a settlement not unlike the one that Columbia has in fact paid, would have had no problem with that, frankly. But immediately things go downhill. So then there's the lawsuit against, or the attack on Harvard, where it's all the research funding. We're kneecapping a crown jewel of our university system in our country over the, you know, anti-Semitism there is just the placeholder to attack universities because we hate them. So it's not surprising that Harvard went in and beat that, at least for the moment, in a lawsuit. So we quickly go from some pretty meritorious things about anti-Semitism or racial discrimination or Title IX, and then we just trip into the blunderbuss authoritarian attack on universities. There is the compact that the administration offered to universities that was not unlike the law firm deals of just get under our thumb and let us boss you around and tell you how your admissions work, how your curriculum works, how your speech policies work in ways that, you know, Trump is always, I'm changing the deal. Pray I don't change it further. I mean, I think as a university, you'd be mad to agree to that compact.
Donald Trump wishes he could be Darth Vader.
Right. And then getting to the other side of the spectrum, which for me is student visas, where the administration is entirely in the wrong. Hundreds, is it thousands of students have been targeted, largely for pro-Palestinian speech. We have episodes like Rumeysa Ozturk being accosted on the street by masked agents because she wrote an op-ed in a student newspaper at Tufts, just basically saying the university should divest from Israel. And the hook here is a McCarthy-era law that lets the Secretary of State deport people in the name of U.S. foreign policy. Their presence here is a threat to U.S. foreign policy. The notion that some tough student or hundreds of foreign students at universities are a threat to our foreign policy is preposterous. Hopefully I've covered the spectrum and given sense to the listener of my, you know, there's some nuance here, but it firmly belongs as a topic in this episode, to be clear.
And we filed a lawsuit challenging the statutory authority that Marco Rubio and the State Department is claiming to kick these people out for just saying things that they believe are contrary to foreign policy, because that's an absurd power to hand to the government.
At the very least, and we could still debate this point, to be clear, but if you want to do some kind of forward-looking new system where you are assessing who is coming into the country, I guess we can discuss that. But you are shooting our entire educational system, the envy of the world, in the foot when you're taking people who already got here on a student visa fair and square and now terrorizing them. You're trying to send the message to talented, smart foreign students not to come here. What is the end game on that?
Right. Well, it's especially galling because, you know, exporting liberty is kind of one of the reasons that we have foreign students in this country. We hope that they take the things they learn here back to their homes and spread American ideals. What we are doing is we are saying, come here, look at us. We have all these freedoms, but you don't. And the second you say something we don't like, we're going to kick you out of here, while at the same time saying, oh, we should have open debate and we should listen to ideas we disagree with. And that's the whole purpose of a university. We are really just not even cutting off the legs of the educational system. We're like reaching in Indiana Jones style and ripping out its heart.
Another vivid image. We're hanging people from the Washington Monument and pulling hearts out.
I'm feeling it today.
Okay. I'm going to say goodbye to our wheel of shit. Plenty of other wedges we didn't get to. I see Associated Press and Gulf of America on there. Sorry for anybody who was keen to hear that one. There are yet others. I do not pretend that this episode was comprehensive, but there's just only so much we can do in one podcast. Ari, let's move forward and look ahead. What happens next? So we now know, a year into this administration, what its attitude toward the First Amendment and free speech is. We should expect further provocations, further aggression, further violations, that's for sure. But big picture, what are you watching? What's the next shoe to drop? Where are things going? That's a buffet of options for you in what you say next.
It's tough. Like, predicting what comes next is kind of trying to figure out what the Supreme Court ruling is going to be based on oral arguments. Like, it's a very, very, very bad idea to even speculate. I usually try to be optimistic in this segment, but I'm having a hard time with this one because, really, as particularly given we're recording this 2 days after Election Day, Democrats did very, very well, much better than expected. They won Virginia governorship. They won whatever state was. They did very well. And that's giving Democrats a shot in the arm in their shutdown strategy. And that, whatever, is neither here nor there. But more globally, I worry that that is going to lead to crackdowns to attempt to stymie advocacy in advance of the midterm elections, because I guarantee you right now the Republicans are crapping themselves about what's going to happen in the midterms. If they haven't already been over the last year, they're probably not very strategic thinkers. But what happened on Tuesday isn't necessarily, you know, complete bellwether, but it should make Republicans worry about the midterms. And so I worry that the administration is going to do whatever it can to crack down on dissent coming up, running up to that election. They're going to do whatever they can in the year they have left to try to hold on to as much of the power as they've grabbed for themselves in the past year. And so I worry that it actually is going to get much worse in the next 12 months.
Yeah, speech around elections, the regularity of the midterm election, the stuff we discussed about domestic organizations and how much does Stephen Miller operationalize this terror groupization of political dissent. I think those are really key things to keep an eye on. One that maybe is a little more professional interest to me. I mean, it's important. I wonder often, will the Republicans complete their 180 turn on social media speech? They were the big tech censorship people in 2022, all about making social media into common carriers that have to take all political speech. And as we discussed earlier with jawboning, the administration is perfectly capable of completely flipping, of shifting from day to night, from black to white. They don't feel obligated to cohere what they're doing today with what they believed a year or 2 years ago. And if that's the case, we may see, there were rumblings of this after the Charlie Kirk assassination, a flip by the right toward straight up mass social media censorship. And I'm interested to see if they complete that turn. They've already done it in smaller ways by making social media into a protect the children talking point, trying to gate off social media, pornography, always the canary in the coal mine with speech, and it is so with online speech. They have yet to do the full heel turn on social media censorship, and I'm curious if they
I'm going
to
offer you an additional depressing prediction on top of yours, and that is they're going to say it's not a flip, and you want to know why? Because they are going to, as they have been over the past year, attempt to criminalize speech that they don't like, which means it's not jawboning because it's illegal speech. It is speech that is not protected. They've been trying to declare more and more speech unprotected by the Constitution, whether it's telling people where ICE is on the street. Seriously, like after Charlie Kirk said, they started insinuating that calling you people fascists is incitement and therefore unprotected. There is a clear line here where they are trying to find ways to declare speech that criticizes them. They're trying to get it all declared unconstitutional so that it's not job owning because it's not protected speech. And so we are allowed to tell the platforms to take it down. That's their game plan.
When they do that, Ari, you and I, what we need to do is say, oh, so you want to be European now?
Now you're going to get me on another rant here.
Because maybe that'll turn them off of it.
No, it won't, because you see all these congressmen complaining about the OSA and DSA over in Europe while simultaneously introducing remarkably similar legislation in the United States. These people have no idea what they're talking about, and they don't care.
These people have no idea what they're talking about. It's a good note to end on. Ari, this has been loads of fun, as always. So glad to have you on. Any work you would like to preview on your way out the door?
That would require me knowing what I'm doing at any given moment. My brain is a bucket with a hole where the bottom should be right now.
It is a testament to what a frequent and beloved guest you are that you don't even feel you need to fill that space with anything. I appreciate it. This has been the Tech Policy Podcast. I am Corbin Barthold. I have been joined by Ari Cohn. If you enjoy conversations like this one, please do go give the podcast 5 stars wherever you listen. Write a review. Tell us what you think about the game show wheel. We could do it again sometime. And tell your friends. Do all the good things. While you go do that, I will get started on the next one. Thank you all.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.